Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of January, the day after the State of the Union address. We all watched and listened yesterday, and we talk about it. The first hour of our program today, David Frum will be joining us, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and Don Gagne will join us later this hour, national political correspondent for National Public Radio, who is in Wisconsin today because, as you know, the president will shortly touch down in Wisconsin on his way to Manitowoc, where he will be meeting with first people from Orion Energy Systems. They work with companies to reduce their electricity use and their carbon emissions. President spent a lot of time yesterday talking about growing the economy and looking at innovation. He talked about tax cuts, freezing discretionary programs, and we'll talk about what those may be. He discussed the health care reform bill and said, let's fix what needs fixing and move forward. He also talked about Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan and Al-Qaeda. We'll look at all of these subjects the first hour of our program today. David Frum is joining us the first half hour, editor of FrumForum.com. He is the author of a number of books, including The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush, and co-author with Richard Perle of An End to Evil, How to Win the War on Terror. His latest book is Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. And he was involved in working in the Bush White House with working on two State of the Union addresses in 2001 and in 2002. We'll welcome phone calls for David and later for Don Gagne. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, David.
Hey there.
Thanks very much for being with us. President said at the end of this address that we do big things in America. Did you see any big things being outlined in this address?
He outlined a lot of big things. They weren't all good things, but a lot of them were big things. Certainly his talk about putting the deficit situation back into some kind of order, that's a big project. Reforming the corporate income tax, which he mentioned with lower rates and fewer loopholes, that's a big project. His energy ideas are also a big project. Unfortunately, they're not a good project.
Why?
If any of you or any of your listeners raise teenagers, you've surely heard the saying, you can tell me what to do, but don't tell me how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do is lower carbon emissions, for example, or establish energy independence. I think those are both good goals. You do that by setting a neutral set of incentives facing all energy users. But the idea that the government would be investing directly in particular technologies or aiding or supporting particular companies, giving loans to companies, that is a formula for catastrophe. We've been doing that since the late 1970s, and it's failed consistently. We saw this in the Bush administration. The Clinton administration had a program to develop a hydrogen motor for cars. They spent $1 billion, and at the end of 8 years, they had nothing to show for it. So the Bush administration canceled the program, set up a whole new program, spent another $1 billion, and again, had nothing to show for it. Government is not a good investment banker, and it shouldn't try to be one.
What about the need to create new jobs, new industries in this country? Can the private sector do that on its own, David?
Well, the private sector is going to have to, because that's how it's always done. It certainly does not work in a country that is struggling with the kind of debt burden that we have to put people on public payrolls. And if you want to make the jobs sustainable, then they have to be in profit-making enterprises that do not require ongoing subsidy. So, for example, a job in a solar energy corporation is a job that will last only so long as the subsidies continue to flow, because at present technology, solar energy just isn't competitive. So those are people who are living on a form of funding that they had better not assume will continue, because we are going to be cutting the government a lot over the next 20 years to pay for the government we bought and didn't pay for over the past 20 years.
The president talked about extending a freeze on discretionary programs to 5 years. There had been talk of being 3 years. What are the discretionary programs, and will that cut a lot of money?
It will not cut a lot of money, and the president, to his credit, was forthright about that. We have a very bad language for the budget. there are two ways the federal government spends money. One is it says it defines criteria. It says anybody who meets a certain set of rules, turns 65, for example, is entitled to a certain set of benefits. When you write that, you don't know in advance how much you're going to spend. It's unpredictable. Everybody who meets certain rules is entitled to that money, and that is why those programs are called entitlements. Other programs, the federal government has every year has an appropriation, and it can decide in advance, we're going to spend so much on defense, we're going to spend so much on roads, so much on the FBI. Those are choices that the government makes annually, and those programs are called discretionary. The non-defense discretionary programs that the president promised to freeze are about 12 cents out of the federal dollar, not very much. The so-called entitlements plus defense, that is where the money is.
He talked about health care reform in that area of the speech, too, saying repealing health care reform would add lots of money, billions of dollars, to our deficit. $1.4 billion, I believe, was his figure. What do you think of that?
Well, I think one of the unfortunate things about the way we do budgeting in the United States is we depend on numbers. So when we don't have them, we use estimates. So there are a series of estimates projected on what the people who advocate the health care reform think the program will save over the next decade. Those numbers are, I would say, almost the one thing we know about them is they're not right. We don't know what the right numbers are. I don't have a better number to offer, but I will bet anything that the actual number produced by the CBO is not right. And I bet you that the CBO director, if we had him on the air, would agree, well, it's probably just our best estimate, but it's quite likely to be wrong. So I think people should be very, very careful about using those kinds of projections. Health spending in particular is notoriously difficult to estimate. The rate of health spending slowed, for example, in the 1990s for reasons that are still not 100% clear, and then it accelerated after 2001 for reasons that are not at all clear.
Anything can be improved, he said, in reference to the health care reform bill, and he got applause when he talked about the bookkeeping problems that small businesses are facing. He said pre-existing conditions, off limits, let's fix what needs fixing and move forward. Is that likely to happen, David?
Well, it had better happen because there's some very, very big problems with the health care bill as enacted. And that's let me just mention one that I think for listeners in your state will matter a great deal, and that is the health care bill greatly increases spending on Medicaid. That is the program for poorer people that is where the costs are divided between the federal government and the states. Bigger Medicaid means more spending by the states. The health care plan promises to meet with additional federal aid some of that state spending. In fact, they promise to cover most of it for a finite period of time. The question as a state taxpayer you have to ask is, are the federal estimates of how much they're going to cover, are they accurate? And what happens when the federal flow of funds ends? And states are going to be facing much higher Medicaid costs that will fall on state property taxes and payroll taxes, or state property taxes and state income taxes, and that is going to be a great burden on people. Where is that? How is that burden to be met? That's very unclear. Another problem embedded in the health reform that I think is very urgent is the way it's financed. I think, as I said before, the financing is quite unrealistic, but they are proposing two new taxes to cover the costs of health care reform. One is a tax on payrolls, and the other is a tax on investment income. I think we would believe we need more of both jobs and investment, not less, but if you tax them, you get less.
Mm-hmm. He talked about Social Security just briefly and said that we need to strengthen the system. Do you worry about the viability of that system?
I worry less about Social Security than I do about Medicare. Social Security is a different difficult political problem, but the shape of the answer is easy to figure out. It's just it's scary to propose if you're a politician, but it's not difficult. The problem was that the president, in outlining the measures that he would accept, ruled out any cuts not only to present Social Security recipients, who agreed must be held harmless, but future Social Security recipients. But if we don't slow the rate at which Social Security benefits grow, I don't know that there is a solution to this program, because the payroll tax that finances Social Security is already so high, it would really be dangerous to the economy to make it higher.
Mm-hmm. Congressman Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, in his response to the president, talked about endless borrowing. It's not a strategy, he said. Spending cuts have to come first. Let's go back to spending cuts. Aren't there enough things that can be cut to make a difference here?
It depends on how long a time frame you look at. If you were to try to do this over the next 3 years, you could not balance the budget with spending cuts over 3 years without doing a train wreck. The Ryan plan does call for a gradual phase-in over time. And I think the areas where we need to make the biggest difference are if we could slow the growth of medical cost inflation, that would restrain both our biggest entitlement program, which is Medicare, and our fastest-growing and most unsustainable health care program, which is Medicaid, and put the government well on the way toward a more sustainable future. I think we'll also be winding down overseas operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that will save a lot of money. I think the Social Security program, President Bush had a very powerful idea, and I think this is the idea we will ultimately adopt, which is for right now, Social Security benefits rise at the same rate as wages. If instead of rising at the same rate of wages, you were to say for the more affluent half of the population, Social Security benefits will rise at the rate of inflation. That is, the benefits will remain constant, but they will not increase as other people in the wage workforce earn more. That would go very, very far to sustaining or shoring up the viability of the Social Security program. These are not hugely dramatic steps, but they have to be taken decisively and they have to be taken early.
Mm-hmm. Tax cuts for the wealthy. He said, before we take money away from our schools, our scholarships away from our students, we should ask millionaires to give up their tax breaks.
Well, the reason we have lower tax rates across the board is not because we are so solicitous of millionaires who did okay in the 2000s. What we're concerned about is our future rate of economic growth. And if we have a very heavy, onerous tax system, the president recognized this when he was talking about the corporate tax. Very high rates do not yield great revenue. That we would be better off with a flatter corporate tax that actually yielded more. One of the things that's very striking when you look at the way the U.S. corporate tax system works is we have some of the highest rates of corporate tax in the developed world, and yet some of the lowest flow of income from the corporate tax in the developed world. Countries that tax at lower rates get more money from their corporate sector proportionally. And that's because when the rate is low, corporations don't invest so much in avoiding the tax. They pay the tax. That's the easier thing to do. And the same is true for individuals. That's something that, by the way, Republicans and Democrats have recognized for a long time, which is why the temporary retention of the Bush tax cuts was passed with so many Democratic votes.
David Frum is our guest. The first half hour, we're responding to the president's State of the Union address last night. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. He is a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush and helped to write two of his State of the Union addresses and has written a number of books. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also email us if phoning is difficult today. That's talk@wpr.org. We start our calls with Cynthia from Middleton. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Thanks for accepting my call.
Sure.
I am admitting flat out I'm a damsel in distress. And I'm hoping I can save some lives with just one simple phone call here today. The president mentioned that he wanted 20 million electric cars on the highway.
1 million by 2015, he said.
1 million?
Yeah.
That's 900 and whatever. That's 1 million too many. I don't think anybody realizes how serious and how dangerous those automobiles truly are at this point.
David, do you know anything about that?
Well, I don't know that they're dangerous. Here's the problem with the president's proposal. Electric cars sound clean. I mean, they don't produce emissions, right? That they just use battery. But so long as we're producing 50% of our power from coal, an electric car is not a clean car. An electric car is simply a mobile coal-burning unit. This would be a very valuable, laudable goal if we had completed the transition to more nuclear power, less coal burning. But the president doesn't propose doing that until 2035. And by the way, he doesn't have any idea about how he's going to do it. And if we get there by special favors, by subsidies, by tax credits, that's a bad way to go. An across-the-board carbon tax, across-the-board energy tax that lets private firms decide what is the most efficient or find the most efficient way to solve this problem, good idea. Special favors for particular firms, bad idea. And I was especially distressed by the president's endorsement of government loans for particular firms. That is a terrible way to go.
He spent a lot of time talking about how other countries are ahead of us. China when it comes to renewable energy, South Korea when it comes to high-speed internet. And he outlined Rebuilding America, where he talked about everything from high-speed rail to high-speed internet, rebuilding of roads, bridges, giving 80% of Americans access to high-speed rail. What did you think of that? And it was a lengthy part of the speech. High-speed wireless, he wants to 98% of Americans. His comparison to other countries and whether or not we really need to move forward on that front to grow businesses.
Well, look, historically, the government has had a big role in the United States in the provision of infrastructure. From the days of the Erie Canal to the building of the internet, that is a recognized government role. And where you can meet the test of cost-benefit analysis, by all means. But a lot of what he was talking about seemed not to make a great deal of sense. And in particular, the promise of 80% of Americans access to high-speed rail. I mean, what does that mean? That means that that you have some theoretical option that it's going to be somewhere in your general vicinity. High-speed rail is a concept that has worked very expensively, even in Europe, where population densities are much higher. There are a lot of reasons to be worried about how it's going to work in the United States.
We pause for a moment, and then we'll take more phone calls. David Frum is our responder to the president's address, the first half hour of the program. Don Gagne is joining us the second half hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Martin and Mequon. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, Kathleen, thank you very much for the good program, and I appreciate it. What I'd like to ask is that you please don't let the guests get away with such unproven platitudes as though they're actual fact. And what I'm referring to is the guest's comment that if tax rates go up, it will stifle innovation and entrepreneurship, and that's just absolutely not true. If a young person has a great idea, wants to make something, if an older person has a new design, a new sales pitch, we're not going to stop and say, oh my gosh, the tax rates went up, let me stop doing anything. It's really just a platitude to win votes and has nothing to do with growing the economy, and I wish you would call your guests out on that a little bit more.
Well, you've done that just now. David, go ahead.
Well, I could say the opposite in reverse. Neither of us have footnoted our comments because that's not the way radio works. But it is not as if there's not a huge body of economic research that backs what I've just said. And, by the way, the surest sign of that is what, in the context, as I did say, of the corporate income tax, the president himself conceded that point. Why the president thinks it's true that high corporate taxes are stifling to growth and invite the tax code to be riddled with loopholes and exemptions that are distorting, but he would not think that that was true of the individual income tax, that makes no sense to me. It is a necessary element of radio conversation that when you invite knowledgeable people on, they're not going to give you economic chapter and verse footnotes for everything they say. But I don't just spout platitudes off my head. If I say something, I may, it's disputable, of course, but believe me that there's research that lies behind why I hold that view.
What do you think, David, of what he said about breaks for oil companies?
What the president said?
Yeah.
I think it's a good point. We have a tax code and we have rules that are heavily distorted in favor of certain energy sources. We're not going to solve that problem, however, by creating even greater proportionally benefits for other forms of energy. The object should be to eliminate preferences, not to insert new ones. And I worry very much that these points about oil become then debaters' points in favor of even greater giveaways proportionally to solar and to wind. You want to get rid of the oil loophole? Get rid of the oil loophole. It does not justify a new loophole for other forms of energy.
I know you've worked on a couple, at least, State of the Union addresses, and you've written recently about what happens behind the scenes. It consumes, you say, the entire executive branch. Every department and agency of government competes to insert its pet project into the speech. Can you tell us more about that process, and did you see any of that at work in last night's address?
Oh, well, last night was an outstanding example of this. I mean, you could just feel it. Michael Waldman, who wrote for speeches for Bill Clinton, has a funny line. He says that the difference between describing something as a priority and something as the priority is measured in the billions of dollars. The president last night, again and again, when the president specifically references high-speed rail, that didn't have to be a priority. And indeed, in the first round of stimulus spending, it wasn't such a big priority. There's going to be they've made some contributions, some down payments on high-speed rail, but actually they've invested surprisingly little. And those of us in the Northeastern Corridor know we're not going to be getting any improvement. I mean, it's still going to be true that to get from Washington to New York will take longer in 2020 than it did in 1960 by train. That's a marker. The president's commitments to solar and wind energy, those are markers. They may or may not be wise, but they are checks that are going to be cashed and that he is going to try to cash in his budget, which he'll be submitting in the next couple of weeks.
And did you notice a change in his political philosophy and the ideas that were important to him? Would you say that he's become more centrist?
I would say he was never as left-wing as he's been represented, this was not a centrist speech. This was a speech that contemplated but what do we mean by centrist? In my view, the center of American politics is the place where Clinton got to in his second term, which is that the government's not going to intervene in the daily workings of the economy, but the government will have a fairly high rate of tax and then use that to fund social welfare programs. If you get to the right, when you start saying we'll have lower rates of tax, and get to the left, when you advocate government directly intervening in the economy. Well, on that ground, he was again and again advocating direct government intervention within the world of particular firms. That's what he wants to do in energy. That's what he wants to do in health care. Obama's genius, his great skill, is he manages to be very conciliatory, very consensus-oriented in the way he does politics. But the goals, the policies he has, are lean as far to the left as we've seen from any president since probably Lyndon Johnson, maybe since earlier.
His comments on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan, are you as optimistic as he appeared to be last night that things are on the right course?
He didn't appear to me to be very optimistic that things are on the right course. He just said he's winding up those commitments. He didn't give us a lot of reason to believe that he thinks are going well. One of the poignant situations he faces as president is that the war he most passionately opposed, the Iraq war, seems to be leading to less horrible results than the war he so strongly supported and has committed more American troops to, and that's the war in Afghanistan. And it's hard for me to imagine that he's going to have a lot of success to report in Afghanistan by the time he says he wants to begin pulling out troops.
Mm-hmm. And yet he did talk about Al-Qaeda safe havens are going down in number, at least in Pakistan, as a result of policies.
Let's hope that's true.
Were you surprised that there were certain issues that were not discussed last night, David?
Well, he did. I think a lot of people have noted that he stayed away from the gun control issue, mm-hmm. which is interesting. That makes sense. Gun control is not very popular in this country. I was surprised he didn't say anything. What I was more surprised by was that he didn't say anything about mental health. That you could as powerfully point to the failings of mental health systems in the United States as a cause of the terrible atrocity in Tucson as to the weakness of American gun control. And that might have been more congenial. It certainly would have encountered less resistance. I think he wanted to say very little about health care in general, and so he stayed away from that, which is unfortunate because, you know, I think when we look back at the end of the 21st century, we look back on how did life get better in the 21st century, I think we're going to see that improvements in mental health and understanding how powerful a cause of human suffering and unhappiness mental disease was, that's going to be near the top of people's lists. And he might have gained some retrospective marks in history for prophecy if he had spoken more about that.
Yeah, I wonder why he didn't, just the final comment before we go to our next guest. It seems to me as though, and the people who were there, who were had somehow been hit so directly by the Tucson tragedy, it had to be a very conscious decision. I'm sure he was advised by many to talk about mental health or to talk about guns or to not, but it had to be the subject of discussion. You've put these together. Would you think that was the case, that at least they talked about it and decided no?
I think that's probably right. Perhaps because he didn't have anything in particular to advocate in either case. I mean, he certainly had unwelcome polling data on the gun question and on the mental health question. I don't know why he didn't. Mm-hmm. It's not like he's averse to spending money.
Thank you, David, so much for being with us.
Bye-bye.
David Frum, editor of FrumForum.com. He's a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush and was involved in putting together two of his State of the Union addresses. We're continuing response to the president's State of the Union last night. Dan Gagne is joining us momentarily. Don is in Wisconsin today because the president is in Wisconsin today in Manitowoc, where he's going to be at Orion Energy Systems. They work with companies to reduce their electricity use and carbon emissions. And, of course, that was all a big part of the president's address last night when he talked about rebuilding America and how we are going to do that. And Don is going to be joining us momentarily. He spends a lot of time on the road because he covers the president. He's actually spent a lot of time on the road during his years with Wisconsin National Public Radio because he's traveled all over the world and done reporting from places all over the world. We're welcoming phone calls again this half hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we're trying to get him on the line here, and we hope to do so momentarily. He, just to tell you a little bit more about Don Gagne, he was White House correspondent during the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, and was at the White House on the morning of September 11th, 2001, providing live reports following the evacuation of the building. He covered the campaign of now President Barack Obama from the Iowa caucuses to the victory night in Chicago. He traveled with him to the Middle East and also to Europe. He has filed stories from around the globe, including Moscow, Beijing, London, Islamabad, Doha, Budapest, Seoul, San Salvador, and Hanoi, and was at President Bush's first ever meeting with Russia's Vladimir Putin in Slovenia in 2001. He will be joining us momentarily, and here is our phone number for you to continue the response to the State of the Union. It's 800-486-8655, and when we're trying to get him, we'll just take another phone call. Because why waste valuable time? Matt from Green Bay. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, I wish I could have posed this to David Frum, but it's so much easier to critique than create. Everybody wants to hammer on taxes. Taxes are evil. Taxes, taxes, taxes. It's a giant monster that everybody's spewing forth now on our land. But we don't want to look at, you know, we need roads that don't collapse like in Minneapolis. We need that our elderly don't wander the streets as they did in the 20s and 30s, that we need to take care of our people. I guess that's my point number one, that, you know, let's get off this mantra of taxes being evil. They aren't. They pay for the things we need, number one. Number two, I find it interesting that nobody's hooked up on the point that President Obama made last night regarding the fish. They're regulated inland by the Interior Department, but once they go into the ocean, they're regulated by another department. And then when they get smoked, it goes through another department. That was a crucial point in this speech that seems to be getting missed by everybody. We have got overlapping waste within the federal government, overlapping competing interests, competing administration, or competing councils, et cetera, that oversee our food quality. We should streamline this stuff and get rid of the billions of dollars in waste. We can settle our debt problems quickly, but nobody's picked up on this point that President Obama's made.
Uh-huh. No, you're right. They haven't. That hasn't been a big thing that was analyzed from the speech. Overall,
I'm sorry, Joy, but the talking heads will all link on the, oh, my God, taxes. It's evil. Taxes are horrible. He's talking about spending. Well, put up one spending cut. If you're going to rail against taxes, put up one program that you're willing to cut spending on, and nobody will do it. But they'll all stand in line cheering, oh, taxes are evil. Well, where are you going to cut the spending? Give me one. One program.
Thank you very much for the call. Matt from Green Bay calling us, and Don Gagne is now joining us. He was in a security checkpoint. He is in Manitowoc covering the president. And, Don, thank you so much for joining us.
glad to be here. It's cold here.
Yeah, I know it is. It is. You know, I can't believe the kind of schedule you keep as well that the president does. There's this huge night, you know, don't get very much sleep, and there you are off in Manitowoc the next morning. It's quite a life, isn't it, Don?
My job description has changed a little bit in the past few months, and I'm not inside the White House bubble quite so much. I'm now doing national politics. And I got to sleep in Milwaukee last night and drive up here. So I wasn't up on Capitol Hill till midnight and then getting up at 3 in the morning.
All right. Good for you. Why do you think that – why did the president choose where he is going today?
This one works on a lot of levels for him, both politically and personally. Certainly, if you look at Orion Energy Industries, where I'm standing right now, out in the parking lot at least, this is just the kind of company he's talking about when he discusses how there are jobs in this new green economy. This place has been, you know, a success story. It's done it with some government help and some breaks and the like, and their business seems to be expanding. So it's the kind of place he likes to highlight. Now, there is an added bonus, and it happens to be in one of the great battleground states in America, Wisconsin, a place that he carried actually quite easily in 2008, but also a place that promises both to be a tough test in 2012, and the place where, if we look at the results of the November election, seems to be trending more Republican. If you look at the sweep of all the statewide offices by the Republicans and the state house and Senate, so they won't talk about those political reasons for him being here, because there are plenty of other reasons for him to be here, but certainly this is one of those places that he's paying a great deal of attention to.
Can you talk a little more, Don, about the kind of government help that the president was outlining to move to a more green America? What kinds of government help would places like Orion be receiving?
Well, they would get tax breaks. They have been getting some government subsidies. In this particular case, Orion is located, at least a portion of the company is located in the building that was vacated by a longtime and very important manufacturer here, Miro Industries, I think is the official name of it. At any rate, I don't have kind of the list of particulars right handy here as I stand outside on exactly what help Orion has gotten, but it is certainly the kind of place that the president says his policies are encouraging, and it's the kind of place that he says the U.S. needs to invest more in.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that he's going to face a tough fight in getting in having the government invest more in places like that? Will the Republicans say that this has got to be done by private industry themselves, not with government support? We simply can't afford it.
Exactly. I mean, we saw the semantics battle playing out over the last 24-48 hours, where the president talks about, yes, we need to shrink government and cut and save money where we can, but we also need to invest. And Republicans see that word invest as just more code for more government spending. So the quick answer to your question is, every one of these battles is going to be very difficult, and the degree to which they work together, will be determined by a lot of factors. Politics being certainly one of them, certainly a big one. I was just in a diner in Manitowoc this morning in the downtown. And there were Republicans and Democrats and independents in there. And for one morning at least, they weren't talking about the Packers so much as they were politics. And I talked to this one gentleman. He's a 42-year-old business owner. He's got 37 employees. And I asked him just, how he feels about the president being here. And I will tell you, most people in the restaurant this morning, no matter their political stripe, were thrilled that the president was here. They think it's good for the community and the like. But this gentleman said to me, he said, I don't know. I mean, he says, I don't know that it's such a good idea that the government is helping to, in his words, you know, subsidize a company like Orion. He said, my business with my 37 employees, you know, we're not getting any government help. So in a nutshell there, you had kind of at least a good chunk of the Republican argument against that word investment that the president said, you know, used so much last night and will use here today.
Yeah. And I'm sure they'll even be happier in Manitowoc should the president say, yes, I will go to the Super Bowl.
Don't mind the beeping bus behind me.
Oh.
the rest of the White House press corps has just arrived. They're in a bus, and they're unloading not too far from me. So,
okay.
I think it's getting quieter now.
How do you think, Don, the president presented himself last night? Is the great conciliator? Is a man of great vision? Who was he?
Well, I think he... I tend to leave it to others to provide that kind of a judgment of him. But I could clearly see a president who was indeed kind of trying to be that conciliator that you describe, reaching across the aisle. And all we have to do is compare this speech to his speech of almost exactly 1 year ago, where he, a year ago, he chastised Republicans, saying that they have to be more than the party that just says no to everything. There wasn't any of that kind of talk last night. Certainly there was talk of some of the differences they have, but you look at the passage where he discussed health care, and he said, it's not perfect, and if you have ideas where you want to fix it, I'm absolutely ready to hear them. And immediately he tossed out one that they can all agree on, the requirement that small businesses file 1099 forms, in certain cases where they didn't used to have to do that. And that got a lot of cheers from the Republicans in the crowd. Mm-hmm. So he was clearly someone who was presenting himself as ready to reach out, ready to work with the other side in order to find solutions they can all agree on.
Considering the fact that we're not that far from Tucson, the horrendous shootings there, and there were people in the gallery who had lost family members or who had saved people sitting with Michelle Obama, were you surprised that some kind of gun legislation or mental health issues were not brought up? It seemed as though they were front and center on many people's minds.
I think in a lot of ways... The White House just kind of felt like it didn't want to go there. That
right.
It might be too hot of a topic. I mean, certainly the specter of Tucson hung over everything in the guests who were there in the gallery and in the black and white ribbons that everybody wore on their lapels and certainly the president noted the absence of Congresswoman Giffords. Right at the top. Now, we did hear from White House officials in the day or two before that the White House is considering a separate speech at some point at some as of yet unscheduled date, but in the not too distant future, where the president addresses the gun issue.
Really?
But again, no specifics on it. But I suspect that there was a sense that it might have just been kind of too much to bring that up in the middle of last night's speech. The other thing, too, is, I mean, there were a lot of things that didn't come up in last night's speech.
Right.
And they really wanted the focus to be on the economy and on those kind of domestic matters. I mean, I think we were almost an hour into it before, you know, any talk of the wars overseas in Iraq and that stuff came up. And, Tunisia came up, but I forgive me if I'm wrong here, but I don't think Egypt did, you know?
And, no, it didn't.
It was a very different kind of State of the Union address in that regard. It wasn't the kind of speech we see so often, where there really is just a long list of things. You can almost feel how each item, you know, was competing for its 20 seconds in the sun during the State of the Union address. You didn't get the sense at all that last night was that kind of a speech.
Don Gagne is our guest. He is standing in a parking lot outside Orion Energy Systems, where the National Press Corps has arrived, because the president will be there, as you know, today. Our number is 800-486-8655. John in Appleton is on the line. Hi, John.
Oh, yes. Well, unfortunately, I'm inside. Not a bad day, though, for Wisconsin. Yes, it was one of the things I was interested in and pleased with yesterday was that Obama basically faced up to the debate that's been kind of one-sided for the last 20-some years about the role of government. If you think back to Clinton when he faced reverses in 94, he kind of adopted the Republican mantra of, you know, the era of big government is over, and, you know, didn't quite go as far as Grover Norquist in saying we should shrink it down to the size where we can drown it in a bathtub. But yesterday, Obama said, you know, hey, you know, the Internet, all these things, our transportation and infrastructure, the research into basic science, these are all proper and important roles of government, and we overlook these things at our peril. And I think at least the debate now is not completely one-sided, and we can say it's not just a question of big government, small government, it's what are the functions and what is the best way to fulfill those functions?
Don.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that description of what the president was doing. I mean, he certainly promoted an activist government last night, a government that needs to be involved in some of these big things. And that's where we got the, you know, his recalling the tale of the launch of Sputnik as the backdrop, and how the government responded to that and set very real goals in response, even when the technology and you know, and then the wherewithal to pull it off didn't quite exist yet. So that is the backdrop, and he did. I mean, it was kind of interesting to see Facebook and I think he mentioned Google too, kind of mentioned in the same breath. But you did also, though, at the same time see him acknowledging kind of the very tough budget realities and the sense politically that the federal deficit and spending is increasingly becoming an issue, if polling is to be believed on that point. So you saw him, I think the line was, I don't have the transcript in front of me, that, you know, he was essentially saying we can't just make government smaller. We can, but it also needs to be better and more efficient. That was very much the message. But he was not backing off from the kind of things he thinks government needs to be involved in.
Don Gagne, our guest this half hour. We're talking about the president's State of the Union. Don is following the president today and is in Manitowoc at the moment, where, as you know, the president will be visiting in just a little while. Not sure how long. We'll take more phone calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Don Gagne is our guest. We go to Chris from Spooner next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hey, I am a diehard conservative and was fairly impressed with the speech, although I was kicking myself or hollering at the radio, yelling, wasn't the stimulus package supposed to be about infrastructure? But besides that, I'm glad that he stayed away from the gun control issue because, you know, the vast majority of Americans feel it's an individual right. And if abortion is an individual right, 53 million babies do not exist today because of that individual right. And nowhere near that many people have been the victim of a gun crime. So I'm very glad that he stayed away from that issue.
Hey, let's go to the stimulus part of what he said. Wasn't the stimulus package supposed to take care of infrastructure, Don?
Well, I think the White House would certainly say that a lot of it did go toward infrastructure. I mean, we all saw the orange cones all over the highways as we drove around, you know, the last couple of years. That was part of it. And I think the point the president is making regarding infrastructure is that it is an ongoing investment that needs to be made, and that the government kind of also always needs to be, looking at that and making sure it's constantly investing in infrastructure. That was essentially my interpretation of what he was saying last night, and I'm kind of in terms of the stimulus portion of the question. I've had conversations along those lines over the last year or so with various White House officials, and that's, you always get some variation on that particular answer, that a lot of it did indeed go for that, but that's not the whole. That's not the whole. The whole of the commitment that needs to be made.
Yeah, healthcare reform. His comments about, well, let's fix some of the things that may be onerous for small businesses, all the paperwork, and let's move forward. Did he put an end to the debate or not?
I don't think so. You still have, you still have Republicans who, the repeal bill passed the House, and it's headed to the Senate, where there are questions the degree to which it will make it to out of committee or to a committee or to the floor. Certainly, we can do the math in the Senate and see that there aren't the votes to pass what the House passed, but. It's that the Republicans are now in the House, having fulfilled their campaign pledge to hold the vote on the bill itself, are now looking at various parts of it. So I think in many ways this next phase of the debate has just begun.
Carl in Houston, Minnesota. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a great show, and I did listen to the whole speech, and I got myself pumped up. I thought it was a great pep talk. And, the State of the Union, have you heard of the Titanic? Studying Revelations in your Bible, the pale horse, Obama the end, and the house of Yahweh. And I think we'll get a lot of great ideas of what we can do to help this nation. But I thank you for taking this call. I'll take my response off the air.
All right. Thanks, Carl. Charles from Ingleside, Illinois. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Kathy.
Hey, Charles.
I was rather sickened by the last speaker who was working for the last administration. Obama's like a man doomed to climb up a hill with a rotten world on the back the last administration left for him. Don't tax the rich, he said, because they have good ideas and then our corporations could carry them out. But we're not taxed in our corporations either, because we're competing with corporations and the rich of other nations that do not tax either. So we're all going broke together, and we send our jobs to a country that doesn't tax. So it doesn't make any sense to me.
Don.
I couldn't hear the full question, or if there was a specific question. We did hear the president. Another area where the White House feels they reached out was, saying he's ready to work with Republicans on simplifying the tax code. And I think that was the point at which he said there are plenty of people on both sides of the aisle who have expressed an eagerness to work on that. So I don't think anybody thinks that will be an easy process either, but that is one of the things that did make it into the speech last night.
Yeah. Where were all the Supreme Court justices? Why weren't they all there?
I have to admit, since I wasn't doing that kind of reporting last night, I don't know the answer to that. I had heard that that at least one of them was, I hear somebody was in Hawaii or on vacation or something, but I don't know. So I just shouldn't say. I saw the six there, and I saw the president greet them.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not hear the explanation for where the others are.
Yeah. And do you think that sitting with each other made a big difference in terms of how the speech was received and in terms of how they will carry on in trying to work with each other?
On the latter, I can toss out the old cliche, only time will tell. But the prevailing mood is that people kind of enjoyed doing it, but there are real differences, and the real battles are going to take place. I can tell you, it's it very much had an impact on just kind of the vibe in the room.
Yes.
Having been in that room for this speech, it is quite a thing to see. I mean, it does feel like the pep rally where you have, you know, one team's fan sitting here and the other team's fan sitting here. And, you know, what one side boos, the other side cheers. And it's a remarkable thing to see in person. And certainly some stood up and some stayed seated on this issue or that last night, but you did not get kind of the raucous pep rally feel and the one side kind of feeding its energy, you know, and then having it switch to the other side. It was just a very different feel in the room. And I found it very interesting, and mm-hmm. I found, you know, some of the pairings interesting.
Yeah.
But
on that point, we have to say goodbye. Don, thank you, and have fun in Manitowoc.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Don. Don Gagne, national political correspondent for NPR, in the parking lot of Orion in Manitowoc, where he will be covering the president's visit to Manitowoc. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and for on-air production. We'll return.